Hello everyone, my name is Cheryl Thomas and I come from Minneapolis, Minnesota in the United States, and it's really my great pleasure to be here. Thank you to the European Association for Law and Psychology for inviting me to speak at your meeting here in St. Petersburg. I've never traveled to Russia. This is a gorgeous city and a very interesting conference program that I see you have, and I think my presentation is going to be probably a little bit different from what I see you've been hearing throughout these few days. I do not come from the academic background. I come from the background of an activist and a lawyer. I have practiced traditional law over my career, but mostly over the last 20 years, I have been working with NGO partners, civil society partners, and some government groups to improve the legal system and government response to domestic violence. We have a small NGO in Minneapolis, Minnesota called the Advocates for Human Rights, where I have done most of my work in this area. It involves a combination of advocacy work with NGO partners and then also linking those people to the legal system so that when domestic violence victims are seeking remedies and looking for sanctions for their violent abusers, that response can actually work effectively to help them. So that's been my experience. We in Minnesota began our work on legal reform and drafting laws on domestic violence about 40 years ago. So it's been a long-standing practice that we've had. We have a domestic violence law that's been on the books since 1979, and every year since that law was drafted, we have actually gone back and changed it. We've amended it. And we have done that because of that synergy, that communication and collaboration with the advocates who are working on the front lines with victims, with the psychologists, with the counselors, with the police, the prosecutors, and judges who say to us, we lawyers who are working on the laws, this provision in the law isn't working so well for victims, or this provision is working but it needs to be adapted or changed or amended. So a lot of that synergy between the activists and the legislation and the police, prosecutors, and judges ends up in the language of the law. We have taken that work and only at the invitation of our partners around the world shared it with those communities, governments, NGO groups who are working on drafting new laws. So we have been doing this a fair amount in this region of the world, in post-Soviet Union states, in the Balkans, in the Baltics, in the Caucasus, in Central Asia. We have been working with groups all over this region since, like I say, about 1994 to do that. So that's where my experience comes from in thinking about what conduct is it that we are going to try to articulate in the language of a law? What behavior, what kinds of physical assaults are we going to prohibit, and how are we going to articulate in the language of actual laws, how are we going to prohibit psychological violence or psychological abuse or mental abuse, it's sometimes called. So that just gives you a little background of what my experience has been and where I come from in addressing this issue. I would love to spend a little bit of time at the end, and I'm going to keep good track of time here because I would really like to hear from you. I don't really want to talk at you for an hour. I'd very much like to hear your thoughts about the presentation I give and your questions about what I've been said throughout the presentation, our methodology and how we've worked, what's happening in the region with the drafting of these laws. I'd love to have that exchange. So if you would keep that in mind as I go through my presentation, that I would really appreciate a conversation at the end, and I'll leave 15-20 minutes for that to happen. Okay? Is there someone that could get me a glass of water? Maybe, is there someone in the back who has some water available? I would love it if that could happen. Okay. One of the ways that we started out in doing our work on domestic violence legal reform in this region in the world and in other countries was documenting the issue. Just going to a community, always, as I say, at the invitation of a local partner, usually an NGO, who wanted to find out what was happening when women were assaulted by their intimate partners in their home. So when I use the term domestic violence, that's what I'm talking about. And there are lots of different ways that domestic violence can be interpreted, but that is the specific issue I'm going to be talking about here today with you is violence between intimate partners, violence between partners who are living together in a home, in a marriage, in possibly a former intimate partner. All of those can be included in these laws. And what we originally started out doing back in the early 90s was documenting what that looked like in country to community and what happened to a victim when she sought legal assistance. Thank you very much. When she sought legal assistance or assistance from social workers or psychologists, or when the police came to her home, when perhaps a neighbor would call, hearing that violence was occurring in the home next door. Thank you. What would the response be? Would it be an effective response? Would it be a response that blamed her for the violence? Would there be ultimately a prosecution based on a preliminary investigation by the police? What would happen if the case ended up in court? So those are the issues we would talk to police, prosecutors, judges, lawyers, victim advocates, sometimes victims themselves would come forward. And in that process, we ended up publishing over these last 20 years about 25 reports on the government and legal system's response to domestic violence. From that work came invitations from our partners throughout this region of the world to help them draft new laws on domestic violence. 20 years ago, most countries in the world, in fact, and in this region also, didn't have specific laws on domestic violence. There weren't order for protection laws. There weren't criminal laws that dealt with domestic violence. There were general assault laws, but they weren't being used to protect domestic violence victims. Now, there are only a few countries in this region now left that don't have laws that are specifically addressed at domestic violence. I think just three or four in a kind of 29 country area in this part of the world. So there's been a dramatic change in systems response to domestic violence in this region and in fact throughout the world. So that's been a very heartening thing to see, and I will be talking about that more throughout my presentation. I would love to get a showing of hands of those of you in the room that work directly with domestic violence victims. Great. Okay, a couple here. Wonderful. Thank you. And psychologists in the room who have counseled or helped domestic violence victims? Great. Thank you. How about police? Police who have arrested violent offenders? Anybody there? Or prosecutors or judges? Anybody in that realm? Lawyers who represent victims of domestic violence? Any of those in the room? Okay. Thank you. That gives me a good idea of who I'm talking to here. These statistics have been gradually being collected over the years, increasingly by regional groups and international groups, and they are documenting that domestic violence is an epidemic, as the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Violence Against Women has quoted. If this were a if this were a disease that we could do a medical test for, we would call it a problem of epidemic proportions. These are just some of the studies that have been done recently. There are many throughout the world now. The World Health Organization report is a very prominent one, found that intimate partner violence affects 30% of worldwide women worldwide, and is the most prevalent type of violence against women that we know of. The World Health Organization estimates that 38% of all women who are murdered are killed by their intimate partners. And these reflect actually the statistics that we've been collecting in the United States over the last 40 years. Those statistics end up being really comparable when these studies are done region to region. The European Union survey that was just completed in March of this year shows equally kind of alarming statistics. That European Union Agency for Fundamental Human Rights did a survey of 28 member states of the European Union and surveyed 42,000 women and found that one in three had been victims of physical or sexual violence since the age of 15. I think it's interesting that those two studies in particular, some of them do, but these two more recently noted that although it's very clear from the research that was done and the conversations with those interviewed, it's emotional and psychological violence is a huge part of what these victims are suffering, that is being humiliated, insulted, intimidated, threatened, having controlling behaviors against them by a partner. But it's not included in the statistics that you see here. In fact, there's currently a lack of agreement, and I'm quoting here, on standard measures of emotional, psychological, partner violence, and the threshold at which acts that can be considered unkind or insulting cross the line into emotional abuse. So there's this real gray area that everybody is struggling with in figuring out how do we think about psychological abuse, emotional abuse in the context of laws and drafting laws, and even it's just in general about the general concept of domestic violence. As that European study said, we do know everywhere we go, every study that I have seen that works, talks with women about emotional abuse, psychological abuse, sometimes we incorporate economic abuse in that conversation. Victims consistently identify psychological violence as a devastating part of the abuse they suffer, and report a wide range of coercive, shaming, intimidating, and threatening behaviors. The physical injuries are so much easier, really, especially when you're thinking about in terms of legal system response. They really are so much easier to document, to prove, to investigate, to prosecute. They're just apparent. They just lend themselves more easily to legal system intervention. And yet you get this overwhelming response from victims that in fact sometimes they feel, even though they have been physically assaulted repeatedly over their lifetimes, that the emotional abuse, the psychological abuse, the isolation, the shaming, the intimidation is a more devastating part of what they've experienced than even the broken bones. So it's something that we know that we can't ignore when we're talking about a legal system response. So let's talk just a little bit more about, I've been using some terms, intimidation, shaming, that kind of behavior, but what is it? What does psychological abuse look like when we're talking about domestic violence? And again, this is something that I have been very surprised to see is so common. The language that is used is so common across borders. It really is there are some differences depending on kind of what tools might be available in a particular society to use. Of course, there'll be differences, I think, for example, of guns in the United States. You don't think about that as psychological violence so much, but in the United States we have this just huge problem with guns, as many of you know. And where a violent abuser has a gun in the home, that actually can be used as a tool of not only, obviously, physical violence, but psychological violence. If that gun is laid out on the table, for example, and just looked at in an effort to intimidate or frighten a victim. I know a judge in Minneapolis who has presided over thousands of domestic violence cases, both in the criminal and civil arena, when victims are applying for orders of protection. She describes a very compelling story where she began to understand this element of fear and psychological violence, you know, that was related to a gun, but really the gun was never used against the victim. The victim described how all the violent offender would have to do would be to take the gun out of the cupboard and lay it on the table. And in some conversation or some argument they were having, or if he was ordering her to do something and she wasn't complying, that would be the mechanism that he would use to scare her and intimidate her, would just be to take the gun out, put it on the table, and look at her as a threatening kind of behavior. Abusers often have many goals in their use of violence. Control is a major one that we have identified in our research on domestic violence. Abusers, of course, controlling their partner has many benefits for abusers. Their priorities, the abuser's priorities and needs in a relationship become paramount if he's able to control his partner. Just practical daily examples. Dinner is on the table when you want it if you maintain control in a relationship. The kids are taken care of more quickly and faster if you're maintaining control in that relationship. The house gets cleaned up. You might have intimate partner relations, sexual relationships, when you want it, where you want it. If you've got control of that in that relationship, and if your partner isn't intimidated and subjugated and is really feeling that control. The tactics that are used to maintain that control are diverse, and we've heard victims talk about many of them. This quote that I have here is from an article written by Professor Evan Stark. He's at the University of Rutgers in New Jersey in the United States, and has done extensive research with victims, talking to them about what is it that their abusers are doing at home to make them feel dominated, subjugated, afraid, intimidated. And this quote I thought was a particularly compelling one. Compel obedience indirectly by depriving victims of vital resources and a support system, exploiting them, dictating preferred choices, and micromanaging their behavior by establishing more or less explicit rules for everyday living. And that is something that we hear victims describe over and over again in our research. Other components of this general category of psychological abuse are related to control, but overlap in the form of shaming and isolating tactics that abusers often use. In the European Union report that I had referred to earlier in my presentation, one in three women out of those, I think it was 42,000 or something, that were interviewed reported belittling or humiliating behavior, forbidding her to leave the house or locking her up, making her watch pornography, scaring or intimidating her, threatening her or those she loves. Sometimes that's pets. We've noticed that in the United States. There might be a family pet that is harmed as a threat to the entire family or the children or the woman who owns that pet. The numbers are even higher than that for reports of isolating behaviors, such as forbidding her to see friends and family, economic violence, forbidding her to work outside the home is a very common one, controlling the checkbook, forbidding her to make independent decisions about money. Other reports of psychological violence, particularly that came out in that European Union report that was published in March, were shaming tactics, such as the use of tattoos, burns, or bite marks to show ownership, forcing a partner again to submit to sexual inspections or participate in sexual acts she finds offensive. So those are all very specific tactics that are used by abusers to continue this kind of shaming, isolating, and controlling behaviors. Another very important, I think, component that research exposes that I think oftentimes the general public doesn't understand is the way that physical violence is used to reinforce the kind of daily message that is sent to a victim through these psychological tactics I'm talking about. And one of the, excuse me, this, can you see that? Can you read that? It's probably hard to read. Okay, you can't read that. That's all right. This is a diagram we refer to as the power and control wheel. And I'll just read you some of the components of it. It was created in 1984 in Duluth, Minnesota. Duluth is a small town about 2 hours north of Minneapolis, our major metropolitan area in Minnesota. And this document formed the basis for one of the first coordinated community responses to domestic violence that happened in the United States, and I think in the world. Back in those years, those early 80s, advocates came together and decided they were going to talk to victims and abusers, in fact, to find out exactly what was happening in these violent relationships? What was it that victims were experiencing? What was it that kept victims in relationships that they really, many people thought, you know, why are they staying? What was it that was happening in that home that was so harmful that often couldn't be seen in the courtroom? And so it wasn't oftentimes a broken bone or a major injury that was, as I said, so devastating to these victims. And the victims came forth with what were just devastating descriptions of what was going on in their homes. In the middle of this circle, those behaviors are described, and they have specific examples given for each one. But on the outside of the circle, we see the terms physical violence and sexual violence. And the idea of this diagram was to indicate graphically how those behaviors in the middle, those behaviors of psychological violence and abuse, were the kind of the ongoing daily abuse that was suffered, and how the physical and sexual violence would punctuate, would reinforce, and keep victims in these relationships and continuing to submit to the kind of psychological abuse that's described in the middle of the wheel. So using coercion and threats can I point? Yeah, right there. using intimidation as you go around the wheel there, using emotional abuse, using isolation, minimizing, denying, and blaming, using children is one of the ways that abusers often keep women in violent relationships, threats to the children, that if you report this, I will leave with the children, or I'll report you, possibly in immigrant situations that we have in the United States, that use of the children, and she may not have immigrant status, he may be threatening her, if you report this abuse, I'll take the children and you'll be deported. That's something we're hearing more and more of in Minnesota. Using economic abuse, again, as I said earlier, is a really significant part of this kind of behavior. So even a single incidence of physical violence or the threat of such violence may be sufficient to establish power and control over a partner over a longer period of time. And then that power and control is reinforced and strengthened by non-physical abuse and coercive behavior. And that's what we're talking about as psychological violence. Some of these behaviors that are articulated in this power and control wheel would even be considered criminal if they were perpetrated outside an intimate partner relationship. And you can just kind of imagine what those would be. Blackmail. Taking the checkbook, ordering that the decisions over money that she makes are made by him. So the money she earns goes into her bank account. Sexual assault. Sexual assault is a very common part of domestic violence, as many of us know. That, of course, is a crime if it's committed in a stranger relationship. More and more, we're seeing it as a crime in a domestic relationship, but that's taken a long time to get to really make that change in thinking. The United Nations framework for model legislation on violence against women reflects the importance of including psychological abuse and mental abuse in domestic violence laws. And just let me give you a little background about what that document is. Anybody here familiar with that? That model framework? Okay, so in 2008, 15 experts from around the world, I was privileged to be a part of that, came to Vienna. And we spent the week drafting what is referred to as the model framework on violence against women. We addressed two topics in particular, focused as the forms of violence that we find are most commonly committed against women around the world, and that is domestic violence and sexual assault. And because so many countries were in the process, there was so much activity going on in drafting new laws on domestic violence and sexual assault, and the drafters of those laws were really looking for standards and model language and examples from around the world where these laws had been in place for some time. So we sat down and drafted, it's probably a 60-page document, with provisions on what should be included in model legislation on violence against women. That document has been being used all around the world now, and every single expert in that group focused very strongly on the importance of including psychological violence as a provision of a new law, and gave that the model framework actually gives some very general language. Here in section 4, legislation should conclude a comprehensive definition of domestic violence, including physical, sexual, psychological, and economic violence. And it was a very interesting discussion because although all of us felt, because of what I've just described, the devastating nature of psychological violence and psychological abuse, and how that is so much a part of what domestic violence victims suffer, everybody was also concerned about how that would be interpreted, how laws would be drafted to reflect it, and really importantly, how legal professionals, police, prosecutors, and judges would be able to enforce that broad general term. The commentary of the of that model legislation was very clear in making sure that the drafters of laws took that into consideration when they were drafting the laws, and said explicitly that we should be aware that the term psychological or mental abuse are open to many interpretations, and they're difficult. As the World Health Organization report that I mentioned earlier, it's very, very difficult to parse that out. What is psychological abuse, and what is an unkind remark? Also, another concern that they articulated was that batterers may use those those terms, that term psychological violence or mental violence, to manipulate the system, to claim that in fact it was she that is the abuser, was the abuser and not him. And this is what I'd like to talk about with you now, because this is what we have seen in some of the research that we have done in countries where we're working with partners in documenting this violence and developing the laws. This slide is an example from Croatia. The Law and Protection of Domestic Violence in Croatia, Article 4, gives this definition of psychological mental violence. Domestic violence is any form of physical, mental, sexual, economic violence, in particular verbal violence, insults, and name-calling. It's very broad, as you can see. Can you imagine the spectrum of behavior that is included in that definition? Likely every one of us has engaged in this kind of behavior as it's defined here in the law in Croatia. The advocates there, I know them well, I know what their intentions were, and I know what they were thinking of when they drafted the language of this law, and that is the kind of behaviors that I talked about earlier that serve to control and subjugate and intimidate and make victims fearful. However, what's happened in Croatia is very difficult. This quote here is from a report that our organization published in 2012. And it demonstrates what we saw were the concerns, for example, in that expert group meeting in Vienna in 2008. We interviewed, as I mentioned we do when we do these reports, many police officers, many prosecutors, many judges, many victims, and there's been a lot of work in Croatia to get this law implemented effectively, to really hold violent offenders accountable, to keep victims safe, but it's been difficult, and as we know, everywhere we've gone, it's always difficult to not only draft the new laws but implement them effectively. This broad definition of psychological violence has had particular problems in Croatia. The highest ranking police officer that we interviewed there explained that he really understood psychological violence that merits arrest to include threats of physical violence, signs that the offender will harm the victim, and really serious intimidation through threats of physical harm. But in fact, our survey of a broader audience, both advocates, lawyers, and other police, led us to this conclusion. Many police officers adopt a more expansive interpretation of domestic violence. Even a verbal argument between spouses can constitute domestic violence and lead to the arrest of both parties. In the worst case, the victim is not only arrested and charged, but also receives greater punishment than the offender. And there were a number of cases that the advocates we were working with were familiar with where this had happened. So you can imagine that the effect that has on a victim of domestic violence. If a police officer reports to the scene of an assault and she is physically harmed, let's say the neighbor has called, there's been a violent incident at the home, she's physically harmed and come to the scene of the assault, and he claims psychological abuse, the police are familiar with the law. They see that psychological violence has been is prohibited under the law. He claims that there's been this terrible argument where she has been so insulting, maybe even threatening, and both parties are then arrested. And you can imagine the harm that will have on her inclination to further report violence. That's the serious kind of violence that I've been talking about earlier, or physical violence that may be threatening to her and putting her at a very high risk of injury or even homicide. So it's a very obviously discouraging impact that kind of result has on victims. Another country where we have been working with advocates there, and we've seen this play out, And I think this definition in the law is in many ways more refined, I think, and possibly easier to use, easier for legal professionals to apply, until you get to that second paragraph where, again, we have this really broad, expansive definition of psychological moral damage. It's so amorphous and so vague that it's just really impossible for legal professionals to apply in a consistent way that sends a message to the community, as laws should, about what conduct is prohibited. In Moldova, again, we reviewed the implementation of the domestic violence law there that was passed in 2007, and heard many reports of domestic violence laws being implemented well, as we did in Croatia, but also just many reports from police, victims, advocates, prosecutors, and judges where this psychological violence being included in the law was hugely problematic. Interviews revealed that aggressors sometimes accuse a victim of psychological violence in response to a victim's claim of physical abuse. So again, police come to the home, there's been a violent assault, she may be physically injured, the children may be injured, and the abuser asserts that he's been a victim of psychological violence. So there is a complaint lodged against her by him, and the police in several cases in Moldova have fined both the victim and the aggressor. We didn't hear any reports of arrest in Moldova, but again, some really discouraging responses from the legal system when the police report to the home. So lots of people have been thinking about this and how to do this better, how to address this issue of including psychological violence in the language of the laws in a way that gets at the kind of behavior that is so harmful and threatening and intimidating, coercive and controlling to victims without using such broad language that it might actually be manipulated by abusers or misunderstood, or just not be able to be applied by legal system officials. This is some language, and I'll just read it to you here because I know you can't read it on the screen there, but one of the ways that has been explored to do this better, to get psychological violence better reflected in our laws, is just better drafting, more refined language that really targets the kind of abuse that we have seen to be the most harmful, the most threatening, to indicate the highest risk to a victim in her home. And this was created again by Evan Stark, the professor from Rutgers, who is the author of the book Coercive Control, a long piece of research and narrative about the kinds of abuse that controlling batterers use. And Professor Stark is actually working around the world now to get this language into laws and to create even a cause of action for what he calls a coercive controlling abuse. So this language acknowledges that domestic violence is often a pattern of behavior. It's not a one-time incident of somebody getting mad and saying, oh, I think you're a jerk, or I think you're insulting another partner, but rather it's a pattern of behavior, like we talked about earlier in that power and control wheel, that's reinforced over and over again, and that is really used to subjugate and control victims. And that's that second paragraph there where I'm reading it now. Coercive behavior is an act or a pattern of acts of assault, threats, humiliation, and intimidation, or other abuse that is used to harm, punish, or frighten the victim. So we're really focusing, as Professor Stark does, on that pattern of continued behavior that often occurs even over a lifetime or a marriage, that reinforces this subjugation, fear, domination. The other paragraph that he's articulated and is promoting the use of in laws around the world is this focus on the particular isolation, coercive, controlling behavior, a range of acts. So not only the pattern that is focused on in the second paragraph there, but the range of acts to really articulate those specifically in the law and getting away from that broader language that is so easily to misinterpret and to misapply. Controlling behavior, a range of acts designed to make a person subordinate or dependent by isolating them from sources of support, exploiting their resources and capabilities for personal gain, depriving them of the means needed for independence, resistance, and escape, and regulating their everyday behavior. We are actually seeing this now in laws, and I was delighted to see when I went to a little tiny country in the South Pacific called Tonga last month. I was invited there. They passed a domestic violence law that's quite comprehensive. It's really actually amazing. It's over 20 pages long, and it's very detailed. And it goes into force July 1st, so whatever that is, next week. And this definition is one of the most specific and comprehensive, and really I think will be effective if it can be implemented in a way that's informed. But mental abuse includes verbal abuse, emotional abuse, and psychological abuse, and I think that word is particularly important, and means a pattern of degrading, humiliating, aggressive, or intimidating conduct towards a victim, including repeated insults, ridicule, or name-calling, repeated threats to cause physical and emotional pain, repeated exhibition of possessiveness, domination, jealousy, which is such to constitute a serious invasion of the victim's privacy, liberty, integrity, or security. So you can see the specificity of that, the refinement of that language gives me much hope in that language will be better applied to truly protect victims and keep the laws from negatively affecting them and being manipulated or misapplied. Another country, not far from you here, I was in Latvia actually last month also, where they have just drafted some new amendments to their civil code to include a domestic violence order for protection remedy. And again, this language has become more refined there, and we'll see how that starts to work in Latvia. Grounds for granting provisional protection from violence apply in cases where a person suffers from, and they start that clause right out, violent control, abuse, forced sexual interaction, threats, humiliation, intimidation, or other violent behavior aimed at harming, punishing, or intimidating the victim. So it's just so much more detailed, refined, richer for legal professionals to apply in really getting at the abuse that these laws intend to prevent and punish. I just thought I should mention this. I'm going to stop here pretty quickly because I promised you we'd leave time for questions and I haven't left much time. But some of you may be familiar with the Istanbul Convention. This is a very powerful document, the strongest international legal standard I have seen, both from the UN or any of the regional human rights bodies. This comes from the Council of Europe, and it was passed in Istanbul in 2011. It has now been ratified by 24 countries. I believe I'm right on that number. They're ratifying it more and more every day, but it includes a very strong language all throughout. This language on psychological violence is a little bit general, but I think, again, reflects that idea that we need to be identifying psychological violence and articulating it in laws in the context of coercion and threats. The other thing I think we we could focus on more to improve our response to psychological violence in the context of domestic violence is implementation. And you can draft the most beautiful law in the world. I have seen this, and we'll see what happens in Tonga and Latvia, where these laws are really incorporating all that we know now about the use of psychological violence in laws. But you can have the most beautiful law in the world, and if it's not implemented by those legal practitioners who are trained in the contextualization of violence, if they don't understand the dynamics of domestic violence, that it is so often this pattern of abuse and coercion and subjugation, then the law won't be implemented effectively. So I think that's a really a powerful tool that we need to focus on more. Is this is a wide open area in our world today, the training of legal professionals to understand the dynamics of domestic violence. What is psychological violence that is the most dangerous to victims in the home? In the United States, I was just going to mention here before I close, and this is, we could talk about this actually for another few hours, but I'll just touch on it briefly. In our law, for example, in Minnesota, we don't include anything about psychological violence. The closest we get is threats of physical violence. In our order for protection law, we include provisions that allow for orders of protection where victims have fear of imminent violence. But it's always, we're talking about physical violence. Even there in the United States, we have what's happening in Croatia, where police are arresting often both parties at the scene of an assault where they can't figure out who the most dangerous party is. And that's a risk that we've been dealing with, the risk where new everywhere, new laws are being passed, and we've been dealing with it in the United States since we passed our first laws 40 years ago. If police and legal professionals aren't trained in identifying the most dangerous person in a domestic violence situation, you will risk arresting and even possibly prosecuting both parties, and that will have a powerful effect in deterring women from reporting domestic violence, and it's already very difficult for them to do so. We've seen from our research already. So we have in the United States what we call primary aggressor policies, and oftentimes those are written right into the law where police are required to determine the primary aggressor at the scene of an assault. So they can't get away with saying, well, I don't know what's going on here when they report to the scene of a domestic violence. She's screaming, he's screaming, she's got a slap, you know, she's got blood, he's got signs of a slap on the face, I don't know what to do, so I'm going to arrest both parties. So we don't allow that anymore. In most states in the United States, we require the police to determine the primary aggressor, and I think that's going to be another really important component of making sure that psychological violence gets dealt with by the legal system in a way that really meets the goals of ending domestic violence and protecting victims and holding violent abusers accountable. So I'm going to stop there. There are some websites you can go to if you'd like further information on any of these issues I've talked about. And like I said, I would love to answer your questions about anything I've talked about. Our methodology, our work in the region, or any of these ideas about how to incorporate psychological violence in the laws. Yes, back here. Do you need a mic? Do you have another one? Is there another? Do you have two mics? Oh, there's my hair. Yeah. Yes, thank you. Wait, can you give me 1 minute? Yeah.
Таким образом, контролируя поведение в patriotici, nascondono la patriotica, non distrano, uccidono i cattici, i cattivi, sbagliano di uccidere i nobili, ma si sta dentro il suo mandato. Per spiegare sul ruolo da prescindere, quali sono la forma di amore che viene patriotica.
Thank you. Thank you for that question, and we do get that, we get that question a lot. And I'll say just a couple things about it. You guys you don't have your, darn, I was thinking that was going to be translated. Okay, so the question is, I hope I have this right. Please correct me if I'm wrong. You have some new provisions in your laws in Russia, and you're finding that women use these new provisions in the law to control their husbands, to claim that they've been sexually abused, to claim that they've been physically assaulted, and they control their husbands that way. They make them afraid that the law will be used against them. Okay, I just want to make sure I had that right. Everybody got that? Okay. What we know, what I know about the research that I'm familiar with is that no matter in what situation, we heard it before in the presentation just before, people do lie. People lie in all contexts, and of course, women lie sometimes too. What we do not know is that women lie about domestic violence to a degree that can, you know, is a high degree, that they lie more about domestic violence than they do about anything else. And I think it's one of the myths, actually. I'll be perfectly frank. I think people are afraid that if there are these laws in place, if there are new remedies for order for protection remedies, if there are new laws that threaten to or will incarcerate abusers for domestic violence, that they'll be used against men in a way that isn't fair and isn't accurate and isn't, you know, obviously appropriate. We have not found that to be the case. I will just tell you that. We do not find that it is a big problem. Okay. Yeah.
Okay,
thank you.
Even when the law is applied, figures don't change, which means women are still killed and abusive behavior, stalking is still in place. So my question is, from your point of view, being a person involved in the legislation, what do you think is still missing? Because all this increase in law, a lot of these men, either they commit suicide or they go to the police, they don't care a damn about, well, I'm overstating, of course, but it's not a deterrent, a sufficient deterrent.
So
I think we're still missing a part, and the Istanbul Convention, if it was in place as it is actually a possible answer. But I think we still missing a part, which is involving perhaps more people, because legislation it's not enough.
Legislation, I couldn't not agree more, is not enough. The legislation is the very first step, I think. It's just the very beginning of an effective community response to domestic violence. This is new. Legal system responding to domestic violence through written language and then implementation is really very new in most of the world. there are a few isolated places, really, truly in the world, where these laws have been in place for a long time. Minnesota happens to be one of them. I really don't know the explanation for that. The UK, Australia, New Zealand, those places have decades of experience in implementing domestic violence laws. But even in Europe, and one of the first domestic violence laws in Europe was passed in 1997. I mean, that's not very long ago. And most, so you think about most legal professionals in the world have had no training. They still have many biases against, they don't understand domestic violence, they don't understand why women don't leave if somebody punches them in the, you know, face. There's many misconceptions, there's just lack of knowledge about the dynamics of domestic violence that leads to an ineffective implementation of the laws that are passed. So I would say, it just takes a long time. I think that's probably what you're experiencing, the person who had the question. It's just going to take a long time for legal professionals to get effective in implementing these laws. And well, I could go on about that, but why don't we take this other question? Yeah.
I can understand the benefit of trying to push across a law that means that police don't turn up to a scene of domestic violence and just arrest the parties.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I can see the benefit that that's the victim. Yeah. Because obviously to be the victim of violence and then be put into the spotlight and accused of being a perpetrator will be very frightening and psychologically distressing. But, as I understand it, it's not the role of the police to pass judgments.
Yeah, yeah.
The role of the police is to collect evidence and, in the UK, present that to the Criminal Prosecution Service, where they will make the judgments. And I'm just wondering, worried that passing a law like this is encouraging the police to overstep their professional boundaries.
Yeah, it's a very legitimate concern. We talk about zero tolerance for violence, and yet a police officer comes to the scene of the assault, and it's clear that he has an injury. You know, she has an injury, and he has an injury. So it's a very difficult situation for police. I acknowledge that. I think it can be dealt with. I think we've trained hundreds of police officers throughout this region in countries where they've just passed new domestic violence laws. And the police officer that I trained with has been arresting batterers for many, many years. And he really does do a very effective job of talking to police officers about how you investigate the scene of an assault in order to determine who the primary aggressor is. You can do it. Police can do it. It's not beyond their expertise. It's an investigative technique. And, you know, it involves looking at the scene, and it involves, if there's, you know, strangulation is a very common part of many domestic violence assaults. We see it in many cases. If she's got red marks around her neck and he's got scratch marks on her face, that's an easy investigation to do. It's an easy documentation on the police report to describe the scratch marks on his face and the bruises around her neck. So, I mean, that's an obvious one, but there are others too. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I understand that, of course, with the correct training, the police can probably identify you as the
primary aggressor.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. At the scene. My point is, it's not the role of the police to pass judgment.
No, they don't. They don't. They're not the ones that pass the judgment, and they just document it. They put it in the police report. But you're talking about the arrest and incarceration,
At the point of arrest. Yeah. If they're only arresting one person, to an extent, that is a judgment that they're passing.
Yeah. I mean, if they aren't able to determine who is the most dangerous and who has committed the crime versus the person that has acted in self-defense, then they have to. But I think you have to make the effort, because if you don't. Right now, we have such a low reporting rate of domestic violence. You know, I don't remember the statistic, but so few women ever even come out and report domestic violence publicly. It's 1 in 7 or something. And after many incidences of abuse, then they finally end up going to the police. And if we end up doing this, if we follow this pattern that some of these countries are doing and sanction her, we're really going to be defeating our our purpose here in getting at what we are, what we know from statistics everywhere have been taken, is an epidemic of violence in our world. We have to do something better, and we don't have all the answers. I know that, but there's more we can do, I think, at the scene of an assault to really figure out who the most dangerous person is there. Thank you for that. And other questions? I think.
I'm worried about a somewhat different issue. I mean, the extreme case, which we see more often than we like to in my country, in Israel, of murder.
Yeah.
A husband murders the wife. There's absolutely no question as to who's perpetrating here, right?
Right.
And what can we do to, what can be done to decrease these cases?
Well, I think all of this material that I've presented here today is important in responding to that question. It is very rare that a relationship goes on harmoniously and lovingly for many years, and then one day a husband kills his wife. The more frequent scenario, the more likely scenario, is that there's been a pattern, this pattern of abusive, dominating, isolating behavior that continues over many years, sometimes punctuated by physical assaults that are never ever exposed, certainly never prosecuted. Police don't arrest even when there are reports of it. So what we actually, the situation you've described is our goal in responding to domestic violence is to get at these cases before they end up in homicides, to get an effective legal system response to cases where it's clear that this is an abusive, dangerous relationship, and prevent that homicide from happening. Yes. Oh, I need my, wait. I'm not sure I understood the first part of your question, but I'll address the second part first. Yes. I should just carry this with me. Okay, try again. Go ahead.
Is the answer to the traditional aggressor a man or the answer to the woman?
Oh, either. Either one.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Women can be primary aggressors. What? Oh, the question was, can women be abusers, and can women be primary aggressors? And absolutely the answer is yes. The research shows that that's rarely the case in domestic violence cases. Those are the facts of the scientific research, is that, I don't know what exactly the statistic is, but it's over 90% of violent offenders in domestic relationships are men. But that's not to say that women don't use violence. Absolutely, they do. It's very interesting. We could talk for about 3 hours on women's use of violence. Oftentimes, it is in the context of self-defense. It oftentimes is not used as a controlling, subjugating, intimidating pattern of behavior. Certainly it could be, but we haven't seen that so much in the research, that that pattern of abusive, dominating, subjugating, isolating behavior by women against men is as common as it is by men against women. But all of these factors here, that this is the policy that we have in Minnesota, where we require our police to determine the primary aggressor at the scene of the assault. And all of those, our law is gender neutral. We don't have any, in Minnesota, if you're a man or woman, it makes no difference. You can go get an order for protection. You can be prosecuted criminally for domestic assault. Now, that's not true in many parts of Europe. Spain, for example, has a gender-specific domestic violence law. I think maybe Italy? I'm not sure about that. The Istanbul Convention is gender-specific. It focuses on women. We don't do that in the United States. We would have constitutional challenges that would not be upheld if we drafted our laws to be gender-specific. Do you see what I mean by that? But also all of these factors here can be applied to men or women. But you can see, you know, some of these things are just very practical considerations. The police can come in and see if there's a 5'2", 100-pound woman and a 6'2", 250-pound man. It's going to be very difficult for the woman to be the primary aggressor. Now, if that were reversed, okay. But there are some real realities about our physicality and about our socialization in the world, men and women. Men are taught to be in control. Men are taught that, you know, you're strong and you know that's a masculinity kind of measurement to be in control. So all of those things are dynamics of domestic violence that play out when men make the choice to be abusive in their relationship. Yes.
За нарушение правил, родители штрафуют, но перед этим их учат твое отношение. Сколько бы сейчас не углубляли наказание для насильника в семье, нужно учить семейным отношениям. Какая профилактическая работа осуществляется у вас для того, чтобы их избежать? Какие превентивные меры профилактические?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, yeah. Well, I do have to disagree that I think if there's repeated acts of violence, our law in Minnesota and many other laws throughout the world now increase the penalties for repeated acts of violence. So if you have a conviction for a misdemeanor, a low-level assault, for example, and then 6 months later you have another conviction for a low-level assault and another one later, pretty soon that becomes a felony. So I think that matters. I think we do need to escalate the penalties for repeated acts of violence. I'm just going to say that separately. I also think that your question about preventive measures, I could not agree with you more. We absolutely have to focus on prevention. And we are doing, I think lots of places in the world are doing a lot of incredibly creative things now to get at the attitudes that ultimately support and nurture the kind of environment that I've been talking about today, that license to abuse and subjugate and dominate and harm women. There is just, we've got to start very young. One of these websites that I showed you up here, it's a United Nations website, has a whole virtual knowledge set of information on working with men to prevent violence, working with men and boys at really early ages, working in all kinds of different men's groups that you wouldn't be even expecting to address violence, Boy Scouts and men's clubs and all that, to really get at attitudes that perpetuate violence and just nurture a more kind of equal view of the relationships between men and women. I've gone way over my time. I'm sorry, I didn't realize it was 6 o'clock. So thank you all very much.